This is JS Party, your weekly celebration of JavaScript and the web. Find us on the web at jsparty.fm, on the Fediverse at jsparty, at changelog.social, and on X at jspartyfm. Thanks to our partners at fly.io, the home of changelog.com. Launch your apps close to your users. Find out how at fly.io. Okay, hey, it's party time, y'all.
Hello, JS Party people. The sound of those VMC beats means that, yes, it is once again your favorite party about JavaScript and the web. I'm K-Ball. I'm your host today. I am joined by one of my favorite co-hosts, Amel. Amel, how's it going?
One of my favorites or favorite? Come on, okay.
Today you're my favorite, Amel. Today you're my... I invited you specially to this episode.
That is true. I feel so special. It just feels great to not be hosting, you know? This is like, I get to relax. I'm honored to be here today, and we have a very exciting topic, so...
We do, and that gets us into introducing our special guests today. We have two experts from the Angular Signals team. First off, let me introduce Alex Rickabaugh. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great. Fantastic. How about yourself?
I am so excited to be here, and we have the two of you partially because we've heard from our listeners that we don't cover Angular enough. So endeavoring to address that both today and in another episode coming up soon. Our second guest, Pavel Kozlowski.
Hey, super excited to be here. And honestly, like, that's like, there are two things. Like, this is outside of the Angular community, right? Like, so we can talk about patterns across frameworks, but also doing this with my partner in crime in Signals, Alex, here is just always fun.
Yeah, well, we're excited to get in. But before we do that, why don't we have the two of you introduce yourselves a little bit more? Tell us about your background and kind of how you got into the Angular world and team. Let's start with Alex.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm a software engineer at Google. I've been there since 2010. And it was not my first job out of college, but it was my first kind of like real job out of college. And I used to work in the Google sales organization on the kind of CRM tools that our ad sales teams used. And we, at the time, were rewriting it from a big like Java GWT application to an Angular application, actually in Angular Dart. And I was working on the backend kind of data fetching layer of that application. And it just so happened that our director was also the director of the Angular team, Brad Green, back in the day. And so Brad asked me, like, hey, do you want to work on this Angular thing full time and solve the same problems at a much bigger scale? And I said yes without really having any idea what I was getting myself into. Like, I had never really thought about a framework or what the framework's role in kind of the, you know, the application ecosystem was. It just sounded interesting. So I kind of rolled my stuff over to, you know, 100 feet to the desk, the Angular team next door.
Nice.
That story reminds me of Devil Wears Prada. I don't know if any of you have seen that movie, but like, you know, where like Annie has the job at Runway, you know, working at this job, you know, she's at this fancy magazine where company where 1,000 girls would kill for that job, but she's just like, whatever, it's just a job, you know? Like, that's awesome. It's like literally 10 million people would kill for that job.
I think I was there 1 month on the team or something when they asked, like, hey, do you want to go to this Angular conference mm-hmm. in Las Vegas? And I said, that sounds fantastic. I've never been to Vegas. Let's do it. And I think Brad was like, okay, great. You're giving the keynote. I'm like, what now? I had never done a public talk, never even been to a JavaScript conference before that. It's like, wow, okay. What did I get myself into?
How about you, Pavel?
So I think like I actually was messing with frameworks for as long as I can remember. For some reason, I was always gravitating toward teams that do those developer tooling. And I guess there is something magical about really doing tools that shape the way we think about the problem and solutions. So I was working in a company doing software for the travel industry that had very strong framework teams, surprise, surprise, and I was on this team. But that was internal UI JavaScript framework. And at some point, we we wanted to move to something more open source. But having this strong team and interest in constructing those tools, we wanted to have some kind of more foot on the ground or like hands in the actual code. So we did something I consider unique. We started collaboration between my company and the Angular team at Google. And for several years, I was actually working on the framework as the open source contributor and joined Google about 2 years ago. So in total, I think I was kind of on a team on and off for a decade and still enjoying it immensely.
Okay, so Powell, I have a funny story to tell you. Another, it's not as cool as the Devil Wears Prada story, but like, I think I met you a decade ago in the Boston area where you were at a meetup that my company was hosting, where you were telling us that you had joined the Angular team and like you were like the first person who wasn't a Googler that was part of Core. And I was like, man, that's so cool. I don't know if you remember that event or know what I'm talking about.
I do remember being like, I think Jeff Whipley was the kind of
running. Yes, Jeff Whipley. Yes, Jeff Whipley organized it. Mm-hmm. And Sharon Diorio.
So I remember being, I was actually on the business trip then and like talking with Jeff and it's like, hey, we've got this meetup. Maybe you just want to like pass by. And I do remember that we had like a kind of Q&A or like a fireside
chat. We did, and it was awesome.
That's just amazing.
Yeah, what a small world. I was just like, hold on a second. I know this story. Oh my goodness. Yeah, okay. Super cool. Yeah.
This is fun.
Anyways, small world. So
that's awesome. Yeah. Well, so continuing on a little bit, y'all are not just here because you work on Angular, but specifically the two of you have been working together on Angular Signals for some time. I don't know how long. I know Signals is a relatively new feature for Angular. Do you want to give us a little bit of the background? Like, why Signals and how did this all come together?
Now it will be interesting. I think we want to hear two stories and then compare notes.
So, you know, Angular JS to Angular, that transition was almost 10 years ago now that we were going through this kind of like rethinking of how the framework would work. And 10 years is about the right time for those kinds of introspection moments. So around 2021, kind of post-pandemic, the Angular team was able to be together in person for kind of the first time since, you know, switching to remote work. We sat down and held a, I like to call it like a design review after the fact, where we did a lot of reflection on like what state the framework was in, all of the different design decisions that had gone into making Angular what it was over the years, kind of those foundational pieces, and whether they were still working for us. Some things were no longer relevant because the web had evolved in that time frame. The job of the framework had shifted significantly. Frameworks used, their main job used to be like making the experience sane across all of the different browsers, especially Internet Explorer. And now, in kind of like the 2020 era, frameworks are more like their primary focus is on offering the best possible developer experience and velocity, really being a tool that enables developers to code and move much more quickly and ship features much more quickly. And so we were looking at Angular through this lens of like, what still will work for us for the next 10 years and which pieces might need changing. And one of the things that we identified as needing to kind of invest in is the framework's reactivity story, which was, you know, built around this library called Zone.js and how Zone kind of interacted with the browser and monkey patched all the different browser APIs to give us this notification that like something might have happened in the application that you need, the framework needs to handle. And for a variety of different reasons, this pattern we didn't think was going to be viable for the next 10 years. Some of that is related to browsers and browser technology. Zone physically can't interact with async await. So we're seeing new browser features that kind of were incompatible with this model. At the same time, you know, Angular applications, Angular as a community was scaling, our applications were getting bigger, people were writing kind of larger and larger projects with it. And we were seeing some of the cracks of the Zone.js model, where this approach of, you know, you just code, you just write your state updates, and like the framework will figure it out. That scales to a point and then it stops working. You start having to actually really care about what's going on, or you end up with situations where the performance of the application gets really bad because you've tripped over some kind of edge case without realizing it. And so we started looking around for what is the foundational piece that we can replace Zone.js with. How can we overhaul the reactivity model of the framework to carry us for the next 10 years and address the kind of core problems with the Zone.js design? And after kind of a number of sessions with Pavo where we sat down and tried out all kinds of different ideas, Signals kind of came to the forefront as checking all of the boxes for what we were really looking for.
Yeah, no, like I think like my story is like very similar, so at least it's good that publicly we've got the same coherent story. But like I do remember this kind of pretty much emotional team gets together where, like, you know, like sitting on 10 years of history, because like I, like many of the ideas of Angular are like were transplanted from AngularJS, so we really are sitting on the 10 years of history and seeing the usage patterns, both like how developers respond to the framework, to its API surface, the concept surface, but also like personally, I was spending like hours and hours with the profiler, so seeing how real applications perform for the users. So we had this mass of understanding of what's going on, how the framework is used and how it behaves on the internet. But there were so many things that we kind of could think of, like what can we improve? What can we do? And there is always a temptation to start with the visible surface, like, oh, maybe this API is not great. Maybe we can just, you know, remove one parameter or remove this function call and so on and so on. But I think we resisted this temptation of doing cosmetic changes and said, like, okay, let's make sure that the foundations are very clear, or like that this is something we want to build on. And like, as Alex was saying, there's a fascinating story that the framework was built, again, based on the same ideas for mapping the data model to the DOM as AngularJS, right? Like, you had this idea of dirty check-in. We change it between AngularJS to Angular significantly, right? Like, we, for example, we do one change detection round instead of trying it 10 times. But fundamentally, that was the same idea, that the framework doesn't know anything about your data model, right? You can use any JavaScript objects, you can change those JavaScript objects wherever, like however you want, and the framework will figure out itself. So that was like a foundational really thing for the framework. Yet what we've noticed is the community, or at least like large part of community, uses the framework very differently, right? They would plug state or events coming from RxJS into the framework. And that was very kind of disconcerting for us, because the framework was built on this idea that like the framework doesn't know anything, use regular data objects, I will figure it out. And people are coming like, hey, I'm going to give you this very structured data with very precise notifications that I'm sending you, like, you know, events, and like, here's this part of the UI is changing, and we're not making any use of this notification, right? Like, because the framework will come and say like, hey, it's great that you told me about like the parts of the UI that you changed, but I'm going to discard this information and start the dirty checking process from the top. So there was this very strong disconnection between how the framework was designed or thought of at the beginning and how it was actually used. And I think like being on this crossroads for longer wouldn't serve us nor the community. So in this sense, we are kind of, I won't say forced, but like there was a moment where we had to make a choice.
You just had to like make the spoon a fork, right? Like if you're like you're using the spoon like it's a fork, so like let's just give you a fork. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Like just reconcile how community and the framework authors think about the tool that we are kind of used together.
I love the story, Keval, like the story of, you know, A, using real world data, right? Like in the wild, like looking at how applications are actually being used. And Angular has the benefit of history and adoption and legacy. And, you know, it has all this rich, like, just a rich tapestry to pull from when you're like looking at user metrics in the wild, like unlike many other applications. And so lucky you. But then like using data to kind of figure out like, okay, well, like clearly there's a disconnect between the way people are using and managing their application state, you know, and the kind of shoving stuff into the framework in ways that weren't designed. And so I love that you kind of went back to the drawing board and like really kind of try to come up with a solution that really I think is so simple, so elegant. And it seems like it's also just something that's being echoed in other libraries and other parts of the community, web community at large. So it's just a great backstory.
So Pavel, you said something that I thought was, the two of you said something that I want to to connect between it. So you said, okay, we were looking at the data and we're like, okay, they're using this in a different way than we anticipated. We need to better match that. And Alex, you said, oh, Signals was a solution that checked all the boxes. There's a gap in between there. How did you go from what you were seeing in the data to here's the boxes we need to check with this new solution? And what were those boxes?
So just before this, maybe like I think the data topic is interesting, right? Like because on one hand, we've got very objective data, right? Like performance, like you fire a profile, get the numbers, it's fast or slow, you compare it with other frameworks on the same page. You've got the, are we like, you know, doing better or worse? The interesting side of data is all the issues or like bug reports or like, you know, all the feedback that we are getting from users. So people would often come to our issue tracker and say like, this something doesn't work and, you know, fix it. And we were looking at this bug like, hey, we cannot fix it because it just doesn't fit our mental model. So like, it's clearly was indicating that our disconnection between those mental models that we as the framework authors and users had. The other things were happening. People would open a feature request like, hey, I want to do X, and we would look at it and it's like, hey, no, I mean, this just doesn't fit into the design of the framework. So there's this, the whole area of data that you have to look at the mass of issues and just trying to understand what people are trying to do, how they are using the tool, and what led them to asking for a very specific thing to which we would, you know, we could just say no, like, yeah, this doesn't make sense in the framework, just like close and done. But I think we kind of invested a lot of time into take a next step and like, okay, what was the intent of the user? Like why they thought about it this way, like how the confusion happened. And this is kind of much less, you know, something you can put in the rows and columns and say like, okay, it checks out or not.
Yeah. And so I like, Amal mentioned something, which is that you really like that we like so data focused and kind of that we have this rich history of 10 years of user feedback, 10 years of interactions. And we recognize and you know, like to talk about that. That's a privileged position to be in the web space. You know, there are not many web technologies that are 10 plus years old. It tends to move fairly quickly. And the other kind of advantage that we have here is Angular is a kind of like Google sponsored, Google built open source project. And it's used fairly heavily within Google as well. You know, it used to be 3,000 applications. I'm not sure even the number today. I haven't checked in a while, but thousands of applications, millions, hundreds of millions of lines of Angular code that we have direct access to and can, you know, not only look at ourselves, but interact with the application developers and ask them, you know, what's working for you, what's not. So we really kind of have all of this information coming in about the framework and how it's used and the kinds of problems people are having with it. So Kibal, you're asking like, how did we go from what the problem is to like, what are the requirements for the solution? And Pavel and I did, you know, kind of, we met fairly regularly for, you know, the better part of a year going through this exercise, starting with the problems and kind of building examples that would fall over and building prototypes and looking at other frameworks. And, you know, even going to kind of academia and papers that are published on not only like this functional reactive programming, but also like the self-adjusting computations. You know, we're not pioneers in this space. There's been a lot of kind of work done before us. I think both of us were fans of SolidJS and what Ryan Carniato is doing in terms of kind of like evangelizing. I think they call him the CEO of Signals. So when we started sitting down, like, okay, what do we want out of this thing? We wanted kind of like a small composable set of concepts. That was pretty clear. We wanted a notification mechanism so the framework would know kind of where data was used as opposed to where data was changed. And we wanted, a small composable set of concepts, knowing where things were read. And we wanted something that was not time-based, where the kind of you're not listening to events, you're watching data change. That's kind of a big split in the kind of academic representation of these topics. There's kind of systems built around events and systems built around values. And we knew that we kind of wanted to be in the value space. And one of Pavel's favorite sayings is like, there aren't 10,000 ways of doing it. When you really list out all of the options, you know, there's just a handful of different approaches here, and Signals kind of stood out as the most mature and the best fit. And if you look at kind of what other frameworks do, Solid is built on signals directly. Vue is built on signals kind of internally. The ref, you know, reactive mechanism is very much signals based. And Preact had just announced that they were doing signals. So you see the kind of web ecosystem converging around this primitive, largely for the same reasons.
So I guess it's probably worth, this is probably a good time for us to maybe just define like what are signals on Angular. And more so just because I myself am confused about this because, you know, there's way too much news in JavaScript land. And I'm saying this as a host of a popular podcast, okay? Just could you give us the timelines for, right? Because what's happening with signals is like we're seeing these echoes in the community. And we see this a lot in the web space, right? Good ideas get traction, right? They get legs, you know, and we know that like everyone's influencing everyone, as you know, popular to contrary belief, you know, framework authors are like very much kind of like in this Renaissance cafe mode where people think, you know, you aren't talking to each other, like quite the opposite. And so I'm just curious, like, can you define what are signals and then give us some timelines and of the influencing?
Right. So it's kind of funny, right? Like, because there's this whole wave of interest in signals and it sounds like it's something completely new and like, oh, why all of a sudden it's here and so on. But like looking back at how we thought about it and the exploration with it, it's almost like there was no other choice. And I'm saying this because I was talking about the split in the road. Like we could either double down on dirty checking philosophy, right? Like we could like, oh, maybe let's improve Zone.js, maybe kind of really put up front this benefit of Angular where you can really use any data model and so on. Or we want to double down on those reactive primitives that deliver like more information that can like help us update UI in the more efficient way. And looking at the applications that were big applications that were successful, we saw them being really written with this reactive patterns in mind. And quite frankly, we did like the mental model of it, right? Like with the, so that was the first choice. So like for us, we want to have a system that can notify the framework that something changed and what change and who is interested. And I think what Alex said is pretty crucial. With those reactive systems, we can track who is reading the values and who is changing them. So we've got perfect information that like, oh, you know, you updated the username. And by the way, it is displayed in this part of the UI. So we can just go only to this part of the UI and refresh it. So that was first big choice, like reactivity versus dirty checking, just to simplify.
Can we double click into the dirty checking thing a bit? Because again, in the spirit of kind of people who are not coming from the Angular space right now, you know, Angular was famous for like two-way data binding back in the day. And literally the words used were like, magic, this is magic. You remember like when Angular 1x first came out, it was just like, oh my God, I just type in this inbox and this other thing updates at the same time. It was just like, and it, because it was like three lines of code to do that. So can you just double, like what is dirty checking?
Right. And I think like Angular always talked about like dirty checking term was in the documentation or we talked about it, but like that's not the only framework from this family. I think internally we often talk that there are just two families of the framework, kind of dirty checking ones and the reactivity ones. And we can go into this, but like Angular and React are pretty like similar in terms of the core of the engine. And the basic idea is that the framework works with incomplete or almost no information what you've changed in your data and still kind of goes about displaying it. And since you work with very limited information, the only way forward is to, well, I will look at the entire UI and see what changed, right? So Angular, we call this process dirty checking. In React, it would be VDOM dipping. But the essential idea is that like you basically look at everything that might change and you compare what you've seen before to what you see now, and if you see difference, you update the UI.
I always compared this to like the games we play as kids where you have the, you know, two pictures and things are slightly different between them and you're trying to like, you know, find the 11 differences.
Spot the difference.
Yes, yep. Yeah. The framework is basically doing that with your data when it's going through change detection or when React is going through VDOM diffing. It's like, okay, you told me you changed something. What was it? I got to find it so I know where in the DOM to go update.
And there's lots of clever data structures you can use to reduce that computation time, but it's never zero, right?
Right. And I think like what we realize with those systems, and again, like that was reflected in the real application, is that in the dirty checking systems, like there is potentially a lot of, you know, guessing to be done. Like you want to go through the large parts of UI to figure out if it changed or not. And the only way you can speed it up is to skip parts of the UI, right? Like, so the way of getting better performance is saying, like, telling the framework, hey, no, just don't look there. I know that it didn't change. And that's very different philosophy from a system which tells the framework exactly what changed, right? Like, so we started to talk about it, like, performance as opt-in, right? Like, you need to kind of, like, say, like, oh, well, like, that's fine. Don't look at this part of the UI. Versus performance by default, so to speak, because you tell the framework exactly, that's fine. Like, I know that only this part happened, and just like you don't even have to bother with the rest.
Yeah, there's something beautifully sort of purist about the idea of like, oh, everything is downstream of state. And so the framework will take care of that magically. And I don't need to think about which things changed. It's just a pure representation of my state. But as you're highlighting, that doesn't scale. And so that abstraction starts to break down when you hit certain performance levels. So you're like, well, it's a reflection of state, but I'm going to tell you that that state didn't change and this state didn't change and this is where it is. And so your beautifully pure abstraction gets messier and messier and closer to reactivity anyway.
Right. And like we can think about like as caching, right? Like if you look at the memo from React, basically the second argument is the cache key, right? Like I'm just telling you like, oh, you don't have to run this computation. And I'm giving you conditions under which you can cache things. So that's the kind of defense mechanism, right? Like you just basically add caches here and there.
That was really excellent framing, Paul. I just want to say thank you so much. Like, you're right. Like, there are really two buckets, you know? It's like frameworks that do dirty checking and frameworks that are more reactive and or are reactive. So thank you for that framing. No pun intended.
Yeah. No, I think that was a great breakdown of that mental model. Let's do the same thing for signals and reactivity. Like, what is the mental model that of how this thing works?
Yeah, so there's a number of different analogies I think that we've used to kind of try to describe it over this time. But the one that works for me is kind of a signal is very much like a variable. It's a box that you can put a value into. And you can, you know, read it like any normal variable. You can look inside the box and take the value and say, okay, you know, like this is the user's name. I need to display it here. But this box has, you can change the value in the box. You can say, hey, I need you to put a new value in here. We're changing the name. But this box has a very special feature where it has a little antenna on it. And when the value changes, it can broadcast a little notification that says, hey, you might need to pay attention to what's inside me. And if you're reading this box, you can kind of like subscribe to those messages, look for those notifications, and know when you need to be updated. So Angular, when it's, you know, rendering a template and reading the values in your signals inside these boxes, kind of knows which boxes it's read so that when one of those things change, it can know which parts of the UI need to kind of be refreshed and which parts haven't changed, which parts can be left stable.
Is that like a build time thing, a runtime thing? Like, where's the initial, like, I know where all the things are happen. Like, where does that happen?
Yeah, so I think, like, you know, like, the funny part about, like, signals that when it clicks, it's such a simple concept in the sense that there are very few moving parts. So we will have to work with many different mental models because different mental models will work for different people. So that's kind of, we use this, like, one mental model that we use is exactly the one that Alex was describing, right? Like, the box for the values that, like, value plus notification, right? Like, so I've got the box, I've got the other box, and so on. Then, you know, like, how do we connect those boxes? So, like, how one piece of state is paying attention to the other piece of state? It's all runtime. So I, like, for the other mental model is like really what we are doing, building a graph at the runtime. So each piece of state is represented as the value. And then if I want to derive a new values from the existing pieces of data, I can just like add another node in the graph and so on. And the act of building this graph is happening behind the scenes. What needs, like, the edges of the graph are added when you access a value, when you open, like we say, like open the box to look what's inside. So like from the, you know, pure computer science point of view, it's really a graph, right? Like we're just building a graph every time we access a value, we read the value. And when this graph is constructed, we can just basically use the edges to propagate a change notification. And it's like, so doing update on one of those boxes or like throwing a new value into the box, I can go back to the graph that was created and I can propagate the notification all the way down to the UI that is actually displaying it. So I know very precisely like, oh, this tiny bit here needs updating.
Yeah, it's like extreme precision brought to you by graph theory, you know? And also graph makes sense in terms of a data structure because it also kind of, it can infinitely scale, right? Like complexity wise without compromising on performance too much. Like it's got a nice perf scale kind of chart, you know, which is great too.
Right. So like, I think as any system, like it has characteristics and trade-offs, right? Like, so when we've got this graph, it's fantastic because it can tell the framework precisely what changed and then like UI updates are very fast. On the other hand, we have to build this graph, so that kind of can be seen as the overhead. So sadly, nothing is free, but I think the trade-offs are on the right side.
And when we're, you know, when you are in the application updating state, as you mentioned, like the cost of doing that scales with kind of like the amount of things that you're making dirty and not necessarily with the like overall size
exactly.
of this graph.
That's exactly it.
Which is a very nice property, you know, unlike something like dirty checking, where like if you have no other information, you have to go through the entire application and verify that that update didn't change every single piece.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's like, you know, somebody creates like 7 new components while like, you know, your like VDOM diff checking just went up by those 7 components, you know? And so whereas this feels much more like, yeah, we're focused on kind of the, like the signals, so to say, you know? So the signal variables.
Just to check, this is completely replaced the Zone.js dirty checking, or there's still like, if I have an old Angular app, do I have to update it all into the signals world, or what's that migration path?
Yes. So our thinking here has actually evolved quite a bit as we've gone through this project. And Angular has always had this mechanism of optionally giving us notifications, very much in the style of like, you don't have to check this part of the graph, right? You could opt into that as a component with the onPush mechanism and then tell us, hey, no, I actually do need to be checked. And because, you know, we focus pretty heavily on backwards compatibility and kind of like not making these hard breaking changes of you have to, you know, rewrite or rethink parts of your application in order to update from one Angular version to the next. So we've been focused on how can we make Zoneless accessible to applications without having to kind of go all in on signals. And so that experience looks like it will work rather well. You'll be able to, as long as your code is kind of compatible with this onPush model, as long as you're giving us the right notifications when you're changing things, even if those aren't coming from signals, you'll be able to take an existing Angular application and turn off zones and kind of run without that piece in place. Signals bring a few things on top of that. First of all, signals are an especially nice way to deliver that notification. It's kind of a lot less overhead and a lot less like needing to remember how to kind of update things to just set a signal and everything propagates correctly. And that's because the existing notification is based on like where you kind of have to do this job of knowing where things are used so you can notify the right components. Signals take care of that for you. Also, the information we get from signals is kind of more fine-grained. And so we're able to optimize the resulting dirty checking operation much better when we do that. So the short answer is no, like you don't need to be using signals to experience Zoneless, but you will have a better and safer experience on Zoneless with signals in the mix.
Now, is that an application-wide switch, or can you know, is it something where you can say, well, this set of components is Zoneless and this set of components, I'm still relying on dirty checking?
To turn off zones is an application-wide decision. Because zone either as a library kind of has to be wrapping your application or not. But we do have a feature in the pipeline called signal components, which are components with kind of extra restrictions and guardrails that can only update through signals. And signal components are kind of by default opted out of the global pass of dirty checking. So you can kind of start shifting your application onto the Signal future, onto the Signal world, and make that like global operation smaller and smaller and smaller as you kind of convert more and more of your code.
So that's like a super opinionated decision. And I'm like eager to hear from you both on this. Like that's like, for me, that's the rule of like, that's how I would use like a linter, you know, for example. I would write like a custom linting rule to say, hey devs, stop it. Stop, stop, stop. You know, do it this way, you know, but you're like, no, we're going to roll this into the framework, you know? So what was the decisioning and motivation behind that?
So I think like, you know, in all the discussions and all the new features that we are planning or changes that we are discussing, there are two voices in the discussion coming from two different corners of the room. Like one, some people would advocate for the current applications, right? Like I've got huge applications, years of investment, big teams. And what those teams are asking for is gradual improvement, right? Like they want framework to evolve, but not break their applications. But then there is the other part of community or voices like, hey, you know, tomorrow I'm starting a new application. I don't have any baggage. I just want to all the goodies, even if they are as breaky as you want. So there is a big balancing act between those two voices, especially that sometimes they kind of converge into one because I might have a greenfield application, but it wants to use third, like, you know, existing libraries that were written with a different set of assumptions. So there's a lot of just thinking of how you get the ecosystem with you without fragmenting it. And I think like that's kind of also reflected how we are rolling out signals. So, and there's probably the whole topic on its own, but essentially we want to make sure that all those new features are accessible to the existing applications as well. And if there's a like bigger split or bigger, you know, jump to make, we want to make sure that there is a enormous benefit of doing it, that you almost feel like I want to invest this time because the benefits are there. But the gradual improvements and bigger jumps where the value is so obvious.
Okay, so I, as an engineering manager, I love that answer so much because it is one that is really conscious and mindful of engineering time and engineering spend, you know, and churn.
Yes.
You know? Right, Cable?
Yes.
Right?
Oh my gosh, yes. No, I'm hearing this and I'm hearing this approach and I'm like, people are like thinking, well, and it gets to... Well,
it's almost like there's real adoption, you know, real adoption of the framework in the wild.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it gets to one of the cruxes or challenges that you get into, like we talked about the benefits of 10 years of data, but one of the challenges of having usage is the inertia that is built up. And, you know, you have the whole like don't break the web thing where browsers can never drop an old feature. Well, there's some amounts of that. And Angular actually has a little bit of a history of not being as cautious about that upgrade path early in its existence. So it's really nice to see y'all being like, wait, incremental change is an important piece of this.
Totes. And this is not just a principle for folks who are listening. Like, this is not just something that like library authors should be doing more of. Like, this is actually a way to engineer safely, like when working in large scale applications. Like, how do you refactor a legacy application from within? You know, Martin Fowler has this really great strangler pattern where, you know, you replace things one module at a time. And, you know, there's lots of like, working on a car engine that's on, it's like very different than turning off the car, taking out the engine, putting it in the shop for 6 months. Nobody's using that car. Nobody's getting value out of it. You know, it's very different. And I feel like so often we're so quick, especially in the JavaScript community, to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And we lose that like really important muscle and skill when it comes to like, how do I refactor? How do I make thoughtful decisions? How do I, you know, come up with a roadmap, you know, that's gradual and safe and pushing to production incrementally without completely like, taking us out of commission for 6 months or whatever, you know, where we're not delivering value or we're re-delivering value, you know what I mean? So just super appreciate that, like, really. And I know how hard it is.
And I think you kind of both touched on two interesting topics. Like, one is that, like, you know, gradual improvement is great for those applications. Again, I think we cannot just do that because, as you mentioned, there's inertia. Like, if we just only do very small gradual changes, then the framework will just, you know, we kind of need to pull the baggage, so we're moving slower than the greenfield frameworks, right? Like, so I think, again, I think we want to jump on bigger problems that are worth solving. But again, if it means that, like, you know, there is effort on the application side, that the value needs to be obvious. So that's kind of want to highlight it. The other interesting aspect of, like, managing change or kind of this transition is there is one thing to do pure code transformations, and we actually can automate a lot of it. I think Angular is kind of pretty famous for all the tooling that we provide with releases that, like, shifts, like, tons of your code to the new APIs. What is interesting to see that it's not enough, because it's one thing to change the code, it's another thing to change the how people think about the framework, how they teach it, and so on and so on. So there is also this aspect of work that we are doing and collaborating with the state management libraries very closely to make sure that if there are new primitives, they can actually be used in the popular libraries, that we are just not, oh, hey, here, signals, and, like, I don't know how to use it. So there is a lot going on in it.
Can we go a little deeper on that? Because I had in my notes to talk about the relationship of signals in RxJS, which I know is hugely adopted in the Angular community and not that much outside of Angular. So we might also need to diverge slightly into talking about observables and what are they. But, like, how are you managing? Well, first, how are you even thinking about the relationship between signals and this other framework for essentially managing notifications about things happening? And second, like, how is that relationship and sort of evolution happening?
So observables are an async primitive. They're implemented in a lot of different varieties, but one particular flavor in JavaScript is the RxJS library. And observables are essentially event emitters. They're this primitive that's able to kind of give you a notification when something happens. And in particular, they're, I would say, like, lazy or cold event emitters. So if you don't subscribe to them, then the whatever action that is going to produce the value eventually is not actually running in the background. So you make an HTTP request with an observable. It's only when you subscribe that the backend request actually gets fired off, and eventually you get the notification back. They have some very interesting properties around composability. So there's a whole set of operators for kind of transforming these streams of values over time and kind of combining them, debouncing them, filtering them, mapping them, flattening them, catching and dealing with errors and things like that. And Angular is kind of famously of two minds about RxJS. Some parts of the framework are built kind of integrated in a more tight fashion, like our HTTP client returns observables, our router kind of deals in observables. And other parts of the framework, such as, you know, the kind of core change detection mechanism and component inputs, are not using observables for notifications. And that's always kind of frustrated some people. And in particular, in our developer surveys, we get, you know, about 50% of Angular developers say, like, please, I need more RxJS. Can you support these extra things? And 50% of our respondents say, like, please, no more RxJS. Like, I don't want to have to deal with this thing. Yeah, so RxJS is kind of one of your options if you're thinking about building a reactive system. It's not in the same kind of category as signals. So the big difference is, like, signals are values that can change over time. And RxJS observables really give you notifications of events that are happening at a specific point in time. And that event might be a value changing, but the way these things compose is very much driven by that distinction. So a signal, you can always ask a signal, like, what is your current value? It will always have an answer for you. Observables, that question doesn't make sense. The observable doesn't have a current value. It only has, like, the next event that will fire at some point. Maybe if you subscribe to it, it will give you a value, but that's not a guarantee.
So just to bring in another set of things here, if I'm understanding correctly, like, if we were to think about observables or an event stream, if you're in an event-based architecture, then you are flattening that into views of some sort. A signal is more like the view. It's like, this is the current state of things and the connections of where it's going to.
Yeah, I think it's, and, like, again, like, just to kind of say differently what Alex said, because I think maybe different words will, like, work with other people, but that's the crucial, like, we are often saying, like, oh, events versus values, and that's kind of sounds abstract. But the good way, or, like, one way of thinking about it is, like, let's say I've got this one primitive, one is just a value in a box. I can always look at this box and like I'm going to get the value, so I can safely assume that, like, you know, I don't have to check for the null values, for example, on undefined and so on. If I subscribe to the event emitter, I'm just subscribing. If there is no event fired, like there was no payload, I don't have a value. So now all of a sudden I need to deal with undefineds everywhere. And I start to compose, let's say, that's fine. Like you can say like, oh, well, like checking for one undefined in template, that's fine, I can do it. But then I start to compose those observables and, you know, maybe all of them can, I need to assume that they will come with the undefined values. And it's kind of one bad apple is, you know, spoiling the whole basket, or, right? Like I always have those things like, oh, I don't know. Like, I mean, maybe I have something to display or not. The other crucial aspect of this is the guarantees around what happens during the subscription, right? Like in signals, I can look at the value. It's non-consequential. Like no one noticed, almost no one noticed. In observables, the act of subscribing is very consequential, right? Like in the case of cold observables, I might be like, I don't know, starting requests to God knows where, and like, I don't know, like all sort of side effects can happen. And on top of this, like each new subscription might start those side effects. So we start to like, it's something that starts on the surface looking very similar in practice has very different consequences. And I think like we kind of collectively need time to see those differences in practice. But both, like Alex mentioned, academia and in papers, like that, those concepts are like very clearly distinguished. And I think we're just in the process of starting to appreciate those differences.
And I would say that like Angular in particular, you know, has a rich history with RxJS. And we've seen both how it's enabled applications to scale to these, you know, like bigger and bigger over the years by using RxJS as this like driver of change notification. But we've also seen how it's continually frustrated new developers who are coming to the framework for the first time to feel like they almost have to become an RxJS expert before they can start to write Angular code in the way that they're being told it should be written. And so we've kind of narrowed this down to RxJS while being a fantastic orchestrator of asynchronous operations for the kind of event streams that you're working with when you're doing data fetching, and in particular, like more complex patterns like, you know, auto completion and debouncing and things. But RxJS is a poor fit for state management, for keeping track of what the current state is and delivering notifications about that state to the UI. Because of what Pavel was saying, that you always have to deal with this fact that like it might not have a value, or it might create an error, or it might have a side effect if you try to look at it. So we really kind of had this fork in the road.
You can also have like unexpected values, right? As well. Like if you're like, depending on when you're observing it, like, you know.
Yes. And in particular, like it with an observable producing a new value. So when the like the sending side says, I have a new value for you, that execution of your subscribers is synchronous. And so you start to depend on the order in which these things are giving notifications and not just on the final state. And we've seen that lead to really subtle and confusing behaviors in applications. Some very large applications were kind of very surprised to see how often, you know, how many executions their subscribers were having because they were observing all of these intermediate states that they didn't intend to be.
Yeah, observables are very powerful. I mean, and the patterns that RxJS kind of amplifies, you know, using observables they're very powerful. I feel like it's like using a Ferrari for every single kind of problem, and you don't need a Ferrari all the time. Like, and I feel like signals is kind of that good in between spot where it's like, you know, gives you 80% of what you can do around managing and, you know, kind of architecting reactivity. But like when you really want the big guns, like you can still reach for them. But the reality is like you don't have to anymore. And I like love that, you know, like it's just now there's something built into the framework that's just very simple that allows you to manage your state and all kinds of things in just a way that is very, very simple and intuitive. And I have to put my hand up to being one of those developers that, you know, for me, one of the barriers to entry I found with Angular has been, well, the newer versions of Angular is just like, whoa, it's very kitchen sink, right? So on the one hand, it's this fantastic, robust, big platform that solves all these problems for developers, the problems they didn't even know they needed solved, right? And then the other hand is like, it's going to take me like 2 years to become an expert in this thing, you know? And I feel like even if I come in as a newbie, like I sometimes feel like I need to know all the history behind like the 10 years of decisions to really be a true expert, you know? So that's tough. That's a tough place to be.
That's very relatable. Like we've heard those stories over and over again, like people saying like, okay, I see the power of this machinery, but like just holding it is just, it's effort, right? Like, yeah. And like, I think like the other interesting aspect that we kind of touched upon here is that like it's RxJS or like those patterns are not that popular in other frameworks. And I must say, like, I don't want to say like surprised, but it is fascinating for me personally, because people that are much into RxJS, they will come to us and say like, hey, but there are so many patterns around orchestration or cancellation of things that if you don't use RxJS, like either you like write a lot of code that is pretty much, you cannot digest it after you wrote it, or your application has bugs. And like the RxJS is perfect tool. So we are trying to understand it. Maybe Angular community like works on those applications that those complex interactions are necessary. And we want to keep RxJS as the tool for those complex scenarios. But there are probably many applications that will just like fire a fetch request, get the data and kind of work with this data. And there's nothing to orchestrate, there's nothing to cancel. And as you said, like giving those people very powerful tools, yeah, that you kind of give them a machinery that is more expensive to operate that they need currently.
So you mentioned a little bit there about, oh, maybe the Angular community is working on these more or something. So I want to use this to transition us to talking about that community a little bit. And you've talked about kind of you have people who are saying, well, RxJS for everything. And other people have been like, please, no more of this. Like, you have a lot of different types of folks using Angular. How do you think about that community? Like, what goes into it? Like, what does that look like?
I'm like particularly proud of our RFC process for this reason, because we know that like we are, first of all, like not representative application developers. You know, various people on the team have experience having built applications in the past, but we are not users of the tool on a day-to-day basis to the level that our, you know, people in our community are. And so every change that we make that is of this scale of like, we want to, you know, think about signals, or we want to think about a new control flow syntax for templates, we write up as a proposal and have a discussion with our community and solicit all of the feedback, right? All of the information. Pavel and I often talk about like the thing that we are most in search of is new information, something which is going to change our minds or adjust our thinking on a topic. And so when we post RFCs, we're really looking for, you know, that one person who comes in and says, oh, actually, this thing doesn't solve my problem because I'm working on a special kind of application and it has these needs. And if you take away, you know, Zone.js, then my thing can't work anymore. Those are the kinds of like points of feedback that are really consequential and help shape our decision making.
So I think like every tool, like every big movement as the framework is creating communities. And I think we all tend to think that our communities are special, and I do believe that Angular community is absolutely special. And I think there are a few ingredients that go into it. There's like, let's say, official part, like we've got a lot of facilities that kind of bring people together. So we've got DevRels that their whole job is actually engage with the community. We do have a GD or Google Developer Expert program where actually members of the Angular community kind of act as the ambassadors of the framework and being this, you know, translation layer between the team and the larger community. So we do have those kind of things designed to facilitate, and Alex mentioned RFC. But I think there is more to it, and like that's kind of pretty personal to me, so I'm sorry if it sounds cheesy, but I think we are trying to be, or at least I'm trying to be, approachable in the very human way. We can talk about technology, right? Like we often use the term, like there is no technology religion. There are just lots of things to juggle. And as I mentioned, we sometimes don't see the things that you see very clearly. So I think on one of the conferences, we had t-shirts, like you can sit with us. That was kind of the manifest of like, hey, we actively seeking those interactions. And another aspect that, that is important for me is the kind of recognizing the fact that we are often that the working on applications or frameworks, it's your job, sometimes it's your hobby, or maybe it's part of your university. It's like a huge part of your life. And that's a huge commitment on people's side. And emotions come into place, right? Like after the whole week of working on something, well, like, you know, you, like you need to, like Friday afternoon and you've got like back to that back. That can be like super frustrating. So there is this deep recognition of the fact that we impact people's lives if we want it or not. And sometimes people will come to us with their lives, with their frustrations. They will come with the good things, but sometimes they will say like, hey, you're totally rubbish. And I think it's part of our job to, you know, go like try to remove those layers of emotion and understand what happened.
Do the product management work and try to understand like, how do I smooth over these edges? I've said this on the show many times where like, but I'll say it again, you know, Angular communities, in my opinion, like hands down, like the best web community, y'all have managed to, in the words of Justin Fagnani, I'm sure you know him, author of Lit, you know, he said that you do a really good job of creating this big tent feel, you know, in your community. And I would agree with him on that. Like, it always feels like family. It's like the cult of Angular in the best of ways, you know? Like, I don't even know how to explain it. Angular people love Angular and they love the Angular community and they're good to each other. They're kind to each other. All about like learning and teaching and knowledge sharing, and Signals significantly reduces this cost. But I think for me, it's a pretty high cost to entry to like become an Angular expert. And I think without that level of engagement from the community in helping uplift everyone else, like, you know, I don't even know if it would be as successful as it is, right? So just really congratulations. And obviously, you made some really big bets with the TypeScript, like about a decade ago. I think that's what the meetup that I was helping kind of, I was like the company representative at that meetup. So I wasn't purely hosting, but I was like sort of co-hosting. That was kind of the big reveal. That was a discussion I think we had, Powell, or one of the discussions was maybe perhaps on TypeScript, and that decision was quite big. So I don't know, very forward thinking in so many ways. And I can't wait to see like what the next 10 years of Angular look like, you know, especially for your like large enterprise apps that are like aging. You know, I'm so eager to kind of see these large, rich JavaScript applications like get updated. But I'm personally like, I still have a lot of questions and thoughts on like RX and compute, and like, I'm like, my head is still in the discussion from 20 minutes ago. But
we could do a whole nother episode on this.
Oh my god.
Well, and I do want to get, and we need to wrap up shortly, but I want to get a little bit into that future facing. So not looking at all of Angular, and we actually, short plug, are going to have another episode with folks, other folks from the Angular team, looking at the future of Angular just in a few more weeks. But thinking particularly about Signals, what does the roadmap look like for you? What's coming down the pipe?
Yeah, so it's actually public. On our GitHub organization, you can go and look at our project backlog for Signals and see exactly what we're working on. But to kind of summarize, we are focused right now on kind of landing all of the pieces of the RFC that we held about a year ago, I think, on Signals in Angular. And so, you know, Signal inputs was very recent. Signal queries is upcoming. Pavel, I think, has that change pretty much wrapped up at this point. We have model inputs, and then kind of the parallel story arc of the zoneless experience. So we're working on, what does zoneless look like for applications? What does zoneless look like for testing? What does zoneless look like for server-side rendering, where they're a whole separate area of concerns? How do I opt into this? How do I migrate? You know, how does Angular help me make sure that my application still continues to work in this mode? There's Signal components, which is kind of like the marriage of Signals and zoneless, adding the kind of like optimized change detection, the guardrails around making sure that you're, you know, not able to create performance problems or to have components that don't update correctly. Beyond that, I think we're really excited about some of the kind of like Signals in server-side rendering space. How can they feed into things like partial hydration, exploring ideas in the space of like resumability? I think there's some really fascinating opportunities there. I don't know, Pavel, did I forget anything?
No, I think like just maybe other way of looking at it. So like there is the whole backlog of tasks, and there are just lots of tasks. But if we would put them into buckets, I think we kind of rolling signals in few stages, right? Like, so the first thing we do, like, hey, core library, you've got this reactive primitive. You can put value in boxes. Have fun, right? Like, that was the first step. From there, we are kind of gradually making the connection between the framework and the core library. So these connections are kind of bi-directional. On one hand, we are using notification from signal, so we can use, like, do rendering more efficiently. So you kind of can talk to or speak to in signals to the framework. Now we are in the, like, so this phase is kind of done. And we are in the next phase where we enriching the framework so we can respond back to you in signals. We recently rolled out inputs as signals, so props as signals, right? Like, so the data incoming to the component can be represented as the reactive value. Alex mentioned queries. This is kind of the next thing in the works. And then when it's done, we want to use the kind of, we talk about it as the guide rails. We kind of introduce the new way of working with the framework. We want to have signal-based components with, like, hey, this is the best set of rules that we can think of at the moment. So this would cover the core framework, but it's not done, right? Like, because Angular being the whole ecosystem, like, we've got internal packages. So there are great examples of the packages we could update to signals, like forms is the prime example. So that's probably what we'll look into after the core of the framework is tackled. And then, you know, we can expand. There is, like, architectural patterns around and managing state on the large scale. And I think we will do this in the partnership with the state management libraries. And we do have a special forum where we engage with those people. So there are, like, layers of onions.
Just to add in, one of the kind of ancillary pieces that I'm most excited about is dev tooling. So we have the Angular dev tools for introspecting applications, and signals and dev tools is a huge opportunity to make the debugging experience and the development experience really smooth. Being able to, like, set breakpoints on signals or see the visualization of the graph and see how the data is flowing in your application, I think is really powerful.
Super, super powerful. Yeah, I think, like, part of Redux's success was, like, Redux dev tools, like, alongside it. It really made that, like, wrangling of data. And actually, the question I wanted to ask you coincidentally is, I'm curious, how does NgRx, which is, like, the Redux flavor of Angular, like Angular's kind of Redux friendly package for doing state management, like, how does that fit into, like, this world of signals? Like, does it matter? Can you use both? Is, like, what's, I'm assuming yes, but I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. So pretty early on in, kind of after we made the internal decision that, like, we want to do Angular on signals, we from the start recognized that this will not be successful unless it is adopted and embraced by the state management community in Angular. And so we reached out to a variety of different projects, including NgRx, and said, hey, let's chat. Let's have a forum. Let's have kind of, you know, biweekly meetings, and let's explore some of these ideas together. And so we've been engaging with them since long before the RFCs even went out, kind of sharing early prototypes of signals with them and getting them kind of involved in the discussions. And so they've been working, all of them, on how to integrate signals into their existing offerings. And so they've been trying to basically solving the same problem we are, which is how do existing applications that are using the current thing kind of incrementally migrate to the new approach. And so there are, you know, there are ways in NgRx now to kind of get signals out instead of getting observables. They have the signal store, which is a reconceptualization of the component store built on signals from the ground up. So we're kind of partnering with them to solve that very problem, to make sure that it's a smooth transition for applications that are using NgRx to start using signals too.
Totes. Yeah, no, that's amazing and strategic and awesome. And I'm sure, like, it's going to be a win for, you know, both projects, right? To kind of have that integration and support and kind of making that more seamless for people that are incrementally adopting those changes. So just super glad to hear that.
Awesome. Well, Alex, Pavel, thank you so much for your time today. Do you have any final thoughts you'd like to leave listeners with before we call it an episode?
I just want to say that, like, that's evolution of the framework. It will take time, as, like, you know, we'll go through different layers of this onion. But regardless of the stage on which are in, I think, like, what matters is your applications and your use cases. So we always want to hear, you know, about what's not working. And there are like GitHub issues probably is the best or kind of the most accessible forum. But just essentially, I think we want to think about all the developers as our colleagues, right? Like we work on the same web space. So yeah, just like let's work together on making the best tool possible.
Yeah, plus one to that. Like I would say, you know, even if you're a React developer, even if you're, you know, using Vue or something else and haven't, you know, experimented with Angular before, give it a try. Even if you're not using it in work, try it, you know, try it out. Give us your feedback because we want to know.
Awesome. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Pavel. Amel?
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure. I've learned so much. And yeah, can't wait for more Angular content in 2024.
Sneak plug again. Coming again in a couple more weeks. All right, this is JS Party and K-Ball signing out.
Picking up what we're putting down, share JS Party with your friends who might also dig it. We were at that conference this week and heard from so many listeners. You know how they found us? Word of mouth. It really works and it really helps us keep this party going. Thank you for helping us spread the word. Next up on the pod, you're gonna like this one. Amel is joined by Dan Abramov to discuss, can you guess? React server components. Here we go again. I'm excited. Thanks once again to our partners at fly.io, to our mysterious friend, Breakmaster Cylinder. New album drops so soon. And to you for listening. We love that you choose to spend time with us. That's all I got, but come back. We'll party together again next week.